This is a Miskatonic University special report.
Hello, this is Keeper Chad with a special roundup episode with four Cthulhu newsmakers who have some ongoing projects to share right now. We've got short interviews coming up with Oscar Rios of Golden Goblin Press on the live Cthulhu Invictus 7th edition Kickstarter. We've got Jeff Moeller from Stygian Fox, who talks about a short scenario collection, Fear's Sharp Little Needles. That Kickstarter only has a few days left now. And Scott Dorward talks to Murph about Chaosium's Two-Headed Serpent Pulp campaign, among other projects. And finally, Brett Kramer of Sentinel Hill Press talks about the status of the refurbished Arkham Gazette issues and other stuff coming down the old Aylesbury Pike. So check out the show notes for links to these projects and enjoy the update.
All right, we are live with Oscar Rios. Thanks so much for joining us. We wanted to just get a news update on some of the goings on with Cthulhu Invictus.
Well, happy to be here and happy to answer anything you might want to talk about. It's a happy day for us here at the Goblin Lair.
Yeah, so this is on Tuesday and we just passed, you just funded last night, is that right?
Yep, just funded last night.
That's great.
Yeah, the first victory of what we hope is many.
Exactly.
As we start knocking down stretch goals.
Right, so let's talk about stretch goals ahead. What's up next? What's the next bar?
Okay, the next bar, which we're already about a third of the way there, is expanded content. The book was originally planned to be about 80,000 words. It's now going to be a minimum of 90,000 words. So that's going to allow us to put in, you know, additional professions, additional mythos tomes, monsters, maybe a new cult, a new patron, maybe a sixth investigator society. So wherever we see an opportunity to add some bonus content, we will. So the overall size of the book is going up.
Great. Can you give me a nutshell, actually? What is Cthulhu Invictus 7th edition guide? What's the era? What is included in this?
Your guide to 7th edition Cthulhu Invictus is all the rules you're going to need to run your 7th edition game in ancient Rome. In the period, and the specific period that we're writing for is the Antonine period, which is Rome, the golden age of Rome, the beginning of the fourth reign of the five good emperors. So kind of after the, you know, after all of the horrible civil wars and before the reign of Marcus Aurelius, when we get the plague and all the, you know, the war with Parthia and Germany. So it's a nice period of peace and stability in the Roman Empire, which I think works well as a backdrop to fighting the mythos, because the only real war going on at this time is the secret war, the shadow war of mythos investigators, you know, protecting the empire from this unseen threat from beyond our reality, from beyond our world, and from within.
Yeah, and we're talking about the second century, roughly 138 to 180, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
For people who have played Call of Cthulhu but haven't played Invictus, give us a sort of sense of flavor and, how's it different?
How it's different is it's a lot less different than people will think. It's a very it's a very structured society, and there's good media and there's a mix of cultures, so it's going to seem very familiar. And then there are going to be things that just happen that you're like, wow, we're really living in a world before the Judeo-Christian value kind of took over everybody's mind. So there's a firm belief in magic and the gods and fate and supernatural forces. The people of this period were very superstitious. They they firmly believed that their empire was protected by the gods and that certain rites and rituals needed to be followed and obeyed to, for the well-being of the empire. So that's one major difference that will be quite interesting, because there are people who practice magic in the empire, and for many it's illegal. There are laws on the books that you can be convicted of witchcraft and cursing someone. So for cultists, they don't have to hide as much, and they have to hide even more, because they can't hide behind this, well, that's ridiculous, there's no such thing as magic. Everyone believes that there's magic. So, you know, your average cultist sorcerer has an easier and harder time. And, you know, there are lots of differences. Life is very, life can be very cheap and very hard. I was running a game recently, playtesting the new rule set, and I'm describing a day of games. And we're saying, okay, there's animal acts, and then there's a break for lunch, you know, and then there's a dancing bear and a really cool dog act. And then there's a break for lunch, and they bring in all of these prisoners out onto the sand, and they make this long speech about, you know, these are condemned prisoners and rapists and traitors to the empire and thieves, and, you know, we're going to be meeting out justice. I said, and then a gate opens, and four hungry black bears enter the arena, and one of my players went, oh, no. And it was a great moment, because for a moment they were in that space, and this could have been Yankee Stadium. This could have been, you know, this could have been Citi Field. It was like any other major sporting event, and they were kind of in that place. And then all of a sudden they realized, we're about to watch live human beings be fed to hungry wild, you know, hungry animals as a public execution. And it's the differences can be so jarring that it's both educational, amusing, and shocking. So playing in the Roman Empire, it really it can push you to be in a different place and try and think in a way that, you know, this is not our world. This is not our period of history. You know, this is another time and another place, and the people accepted things as normal that we never would, like magic and public executions and you know, institutionalized slavery. So it offers some really unique role-playing challenges.
Right. I wanted to cover some updates that you've had in the Kickstarter. One of the things that I noticed is you've got a new pledge level called Provincial Citizens to help out people overseas who want to get this product. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we've had a lot of trouble, and I'm going to take most of the blame on that, for setting up print-on-demand services. But just this week after the launch of the Kickstarter, we finally got our first set of files uploaded for Tales of the Caribbean. So we'll be fulfilling our print-on-demand commitments for those soon. But now that we're set up and we're through all of the approval stages and all of that, now we can start, well, you know, once these files are ready to print domestically, we can start printing them through our POD provider. And we'll be able to print these books overseas and ship them at a much cheaper cost than shipping them directly from New York.
Gotcha.
So it does halves the international mailing rate of what we were facing originally, which, again, as high as it is, it's really something out of my control. Even in the 3 years that we've been, you know, this is our fourth year, the rates have really increased about 30%. It's gotten quite ruinous for a small business to try and support an international community. So we're hoping print on demand is going to be the way to fulfill these commitments to our international fans moving forward. We really think it's going to be a much bigger part of every Kickstarter moving forward now.
That's great. It is sort of a strange quirk of the Kickstarter system that when you launch a Kickstarter, the shipping costs are not the same as when you ship. You can actually get changes right in the interim.
Yeah, unfortunately, the rate changed in the course of our last Kickstarter, and for many of those international backers, we saw a loss. So raising it between then and now was just an unfortunate reaction to what had happened. And I feel badly that it came as a shock to so many backers, which is why I'm so glad that we were able to finally get our print-on-demand issues sorted out. And we can offer that because, I mean, we want everybody who wants a physical copy to get one.
Right. Yeah. And we're sort of in the middle of a living experiment business-wise. Everyone with this backer, you know, Patreon, all this, these kinds of new models. So hopefully these are solutions that get worked out over time.
Right. Right.
So talking about the expanded content and other stretch goals, we talked about stretch goal one, I think. Have we talked about two and three? I think not, right?
Stretch goal two will be expanded art. We're going to increase the amount of our interior art by about 30%. We have a kind of calculation, one piece of art for every, you know, X amount of words. So as, of course, the words go up, the art budget will go up as well. But this stretch goal will bump that up even further, allowing us to have more original interior art.
That's great. And we're looking at some more fiction ahead.
If yes. We reach yes.
The 28,000 mark.
Yeah. It's 28,000 is stretch goal three, Further Tales of Cthulhu Invictus. It is a fiction collection of, I believe, 9 stories. 8. I know it's 10. 10 fiction stories by a lot of really amazing authors. Some will be very familiar to people who followed our fiction. A lot of people who were in the first first Cthulhu Invictus fiction collection have returned again for this one, and that is Further Tales of Cthulhu Invictus, more stories of battling the Cthulhu mythos in ancient Rome. Beautiful cover, really loving the art we're getting for this project. Any backer above the $25 level will get a digital version of the collection, you know, on Mobi, ebook, PDF, whatever they'd like. They'll get a code and they'll be able to download the fiction collection to their device. And physical copies will be printed and available as an add-on item to most backer levels. Some backer levels are purely digital. And of course, the overseas print-on-demand backer level, you're not going to be able to add on items from New York, because then you're defeating the whole reason you're doing print-on-demand to avoid international shipping. So that will be one of the stretch goals we're most excited about. And I have to tell everyone, that book is written. This is not, it is done. It's being edited. It's just waiting to be funded. So literally probably within a month of the close of the Kickstarter, this could go out. So you'll be able to read your collection of Cthulhu Invictus short stories over the summer, and, you know, Jupiter willing, have the rule book, a digital version of it at least by the end of the summer.
It's a pretty good order to get things delivered in. You can look for hooks and inspiration in the fiction, and then run your game for your group in the fall.
Right. Yeah. But the book is coming along very nicely. I've gotten, I believe, 6 of the 11 chapters done, and one and the included scenario. So those are already in editing.
That's great. I did want to mention the fourth stretch goal that's listed here at 30,000. We'll get a scenario by Chad Bowser.
Yes. Chad's already working on that. It's I'm not going to attempt the Latin title, but it is basically, as I've described it, a story of disease, death, life in that order, and possibly redemption. So it's a scenario that takes place during a plague hitting the empire. You know, the empire was we're talking about an era, a time before antibiotics, and also a time when people traveled quite a bit, and large groups of people, like refugees and armies. So somebody picking up a rare new disease in the east will quickly bring it to the center of the empire where no one has immunity to it. So plague was a problem in the empire historically. And this scenario will deal with take place during a plague when some of the unfortunate victims of the plague don't stay dead for long.
No, that's a terrible symptom.
Yes. 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 It's not a symptom of recovery.
Right. No, it's pretty damning. You thought buboes were bad.
Yeah. 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 This is not going to go well. But I'm thrilled to have Chad Bowser, one of the creators of Cthulhu Invictus, involved and supporting the project with an original scenario. I'm just really, really excited. I'm probably one of the biggest fans of Cthulhu Invictus on the planet. You know, I've loved running it. I've loved writing it. I've loved, the few times I've gotten to playing it. So just getting a new scenario and being able to read a new original scenario by Chad is kind of exciting for me.
So I think, you know, people who are fans of Cthulhu Invictus are sort of the choir to which we preach here. So I thought maybe, yeah, let's do a little role play. I'm Joe Cthulhu. We just met at a convention. Mm-hmm. And good to meet you. I know nothing about Roman history, and I'm a keeper in my home group, and I'm interested, but I'm a little intimidated about approaching this. Why should I get this?
Have you run Call of Cthulhu for your home group before?
Yes, we have. We've run through campaigns. We just went through a massive Nyarlathotep campaign, and we went right into Shadows of Yogg-Sothoth. And yeah, we're
okay. So
it's
you've
a
done
dedicated group.
Okay. I'm assuming most of you started in the realm of fantasy, in the realm of some kind of a sword and sorcery kind of role playing. Very few people start with Call of Cthulhu.
That's right. We played for 20 years. We played a Tunnels and Trolls campaign, and that's pretty much where we started. Okay, then we picked up this game.
So Cthulhu Invictus is going to be the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup of all of your role playing experiences in your entire life. It's going to talk to that nostalgia of your fantasy sword armor, you know, that sort of adventure base, and then it's going to talk to your current state of cosmic horror investigative role playing in a setting that's not an upward power building. It's almost a downward mental spiral. So you're going to have that you know, sword swinging, shield wall, you know, bows and arrows, you know, taverns and brothels and gold coins and all of that. But it's all going, and then, you know, you're going to have your deep ones and cultists and great old ones, you know, sinister cults that you know and already love. I have to tell you, you're probably going to be surprised at how familiar and seamless it all starts to become. And it's not written for people who require some kind of a degree in ancient history. It's being written to be very accessible, very easy to understand and involve in. You know, you're going to learn a lot about it about the period without really realizing you're learning a lot about the period. You're just going to be running your game, playing your character, having a good time, and then afterwards, hopefully over a glass of wine or a mug of beer, you'll talk about it, and it will spark a conversation about the history of the period. So yeah, that's my sales pitch. If you've ever played a fantasy game, if you currently play any form of Call of Cthulhu, if you're a fan of the 7th edition system, you're practically already a Cthulhu Invictus fan. You just haven't tried it yet.
Yeah, and this is clearly the launch of a line. It's not just a Kickstarter.
We've got plans within right. plans. We've got three setting books planned over the next few years, and our backers will be picking which one we make next. For some of our backer levels, they get a vote. The senatorial level and the royal family level, they all get votes on which of the three setting books we will be producing first. So at the close of this Kickstarter, when their backer surveys go out, they'll get to vote. And when that vote is determined, we will alert our author to get writing. And there are other things planned. We already have a completed adventure collection that was going to come out this year. It will probably be coming out next year. We are discussing the next campaign for Cthulhu Invictus. We do not have a title. We do not have an author or a concept or an accepted contract from Chaosium, but it is in the works. We have another really interesting concept that we're currently discussing with Chaosium, and that's going to be called, we do not have an agreement in place with Chaosium yet, but we're in discussions for producing a book called Threats to the Empire, which will be 50 new creatures for Cthulhu Invictus and probably about a dozen new cults. Well, 50, a bunch of creatures, a bunch of cults, and a bunch of really kind of messed up NPCs. kind of a rogue gallery, because you don't need friends to be dangerous. You know, there's that lone madman who can really mess some stuff up. So sometimes people don't play with others, it all starts with this Kickstarter, and now that we've funded, we're off to a good start.
Yeah, it's looking good so far. So this will drop on Friday. I guess I won't mention numbers, but you have funded and things are on pace, looking good so far. If you want to get in on this, you've got more than 3 weeks to go to pledge and check it out. We'll have all the links that you need in the show notes.
Other stretch goals that we have coming up are going to be a PDF, which is going to be a collection of 18 pre-generated 7th edition investigators. We are really hoping we can reach the stretch goal where we get to produce the Cthulhu Invictus Keeper screen. We are going to be doing another PDF that's a 7th edition conversion of our first collection to Horror Cosmico, so that the new 7th edition rules, those scenarios can be played with the new 7th edition rule set. And we're most excited to be hopefully reaching the point where we get to acquire the rights to the Legacy of Arius Lurko, whereupon we will be updating it for 7th edition and re-releasing it with a fifth scenario, an expanded 7th edition version of the Legacy of Arius Lurko.
Thanks very much, Oscar, for talking to us, for giving us a little news update on the Cthulhu Invictus progress.
Well, thank you for having me. Please join us. The Empire needs you.
Hello, and now we're talking to Jeff Moeller, editor for Stygian Fox, to talk about a Kickstarter project that's live right now for a few more days anyway. It's called Fear's Sharp Little Needles. And I take it this is your brainchild, is that right?
Yeah, I'm the I conceived of it originally, and I'm the editor. I'm the guy who's responsible for taking what's now 30 scenarios and whipping them into shape. So we had last year we had a Kickstarter called The Things We Leave Behind, which was and our kind of our mission statement was to come up with some really modern scenarios. You know, not, you know, things that were stuck in the 80s or 90s or that, you know, depended on a particular organization, but that were, you know, very modern in terms of their clue trees and their settings and the use of technology and, you know, the threats that technology face and, you know, kind of modern elements of fear and isolation. So we pulled that together. It took us a few years, but if the book itself, it ended up being six scenarios. They're all very long and involved and would take several sessions to play. And when we were, it did well, and we were looking for a follow-up and batting around ideas. And Steph and I both kind of came up with the idea of, you know, what we really need is things that can be played, you know, similar ideas, very modern, set right now, but that can be played in a session, you know, a few hours, and it would be very easy for somebody to pick up and run at a con or as a one-off. We didn't really think there was anything out there like that. And, you know, Steph initially said, well, yeah, we should do like a PDF of, you know, six or so. And I said, no, if we're going to do them, I'm going to ask just about everybody I know to submit. And, you know, and that is kind of what I did. I sent out inquiries to just about everybody I could think of or had worked with or had ever been in a book with and said, hey, can you write a super modern, scary, you know, 3,000 word scenario with, you know, still has some elements of gameplay and decision making. And this is going to be a good old fashioned community barn raising.
Yeah. So, and many answered your call.
many. We have, there are 30 scenarios, and I think there's a couple of repeats, but there are north of 20 authors, all of whom, except for two, have been published before. And I'm very happy with the two who haven't. One was an acquaintance of two. The two who haven't are acquaintances of Steph's in Great Britain, and I've read and been through their scenarios, and they're both top notch. I'm very happy with them. So, but everybody else's names you'd know.
Yeah, yeah. Can we call them out by name? The new guys. I'm looking for.
Oh yeah, Joe Trier. Joe has a podcast. I think it's called How We Roll. And then there is a very talented and well-spoken young woman named Helen Gould in the United Kingdom who sent me three amazing pitches and just forced me to choose between them. So, and I was very happy with her. Very happy with her submission as well.
I got to tell you, I am loving this concept actually of the 3,000 word scenario, the one night thing. I feel like a lot of people do play that way.
Yeah,
and it's great to kind of fill a niche, I feel.
Yeah, there were somebody on the board or somewhere mentioned. Trying to avoid there was a book out about 15, 20 years ago from Chaosium called Minions, which kind of tried to do the same thing, but it was mostly kind of a stitched together kind of mini campaign. These aren't that way. They're all standalone. Although as I'm kind of going through, I'm sort of adding boxes where, you know, if you like this one, you know, you might follow up with this one, and here's a potential connection for them. So I'm doing a little bit of weaving, but not too much. I'm trying to let them stand by themselves. But I found that the trick to it is to getting a good one in 3,000 words tends to be lead up to a decision and force the investigators to make it. When they have a horrible choice to make, if you keep it to, you know, basically one turning point, you can get a good story in that kind of length while still being, you know, complete and scary. So
right. And in keeping with what seems to be Stygian Fox's aesthetic, these are meant to be gritty, a bit bleak, right? These are not pulp in any way, I see from promo copy.
They're not pulp. They are bleak is a good word. When we put out The Things We Leave Behind, we put a kind of a mature audience label on it, and people kind of wondered what we meant by that. We didn't mean mature in the kind of the lurid or prurient sense, because none of them are that way. We meant that, I don't want my 12-year-old daughter reading this book, simply because right. it's, you know, the things you have to do are, the decisions that people are put to are bleak. I believe in, heroic narratives, so. I don't like no-win situations, but I do like situations that make the players think about what the right thing to do is. So we do tend to lean that way, and we don't shy away from crime. I guess that's kind of a good way to put it. Bad things happen to our protagonists. I always say the heroic narrative lies in striving to make the best out of a bad situation.
Right, and you've invoked names like True Detective and Hannibal as kind of genre examples.
Right. Let me give you an example. I can talk about mine. I contributed one to a little bit of spoilers here. My short scenario is called Separation Anxiety. And it's a procedural investigation. You have to find a missing person. When you do find the missing person, it's both horrible what you find, and you have to make a rather difficult ethical decision. Basically you end up on one of those kinds of farms, if you know what I mean. And what's going on at the farm is a quandary for the investigators. But it's a little bit influenced. I don't know if you're familiar with if you watch much J-horror at all, or if you're familiar with the work of Mikey. But there's a film called Audition.
Oh yeah,
it's one of my favorite films.
Oh, yeah.
It makes me cringe. My impressions of that film definitely influenced my scenario, and it's very bleak at the end. What you find is not pretty, and what you do about it is a difficult decision. So, that's the aesthetic. It's not, you know, we don't do things that we consider gratuitous, but it is bleak. It's, you know, I would say we're an R-rated imprint.
Right. Yeah. Audition. I don't even know. I love it. I have a sort of subgenre in my archives that I like to call bad mood films.
Yeah.
Sort of like Lars von Trier.
It's one of my top 10 favorite films. Although I still cringe. It's still cringeworthy for me. So,
oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's hard to watch.
Yeah.
Well, so that's that's fun to expose people to that in a game sense. Actually, I'm completely behind that. I love when horror gaming does not shy away from, you know, from facing these things head on. It's great.
Yeah.
And the Kickstarter is doing really well. You're certainly way past the goal.
Yeah. We're sort of repeating our model from last time, which is we are five times funded, so that's great. We're passing out more cents per word to the contributors as we make progress. It's going to be, as I say, it's right now it's 24 scenarios. I've got six more I got to figure out what to do with, if I'm going to put them in the main book or put them in the Kickstarter exclusive. As we did last time, we're going to do a PDF of additional material that is a Kickstarter exclusive and that can be used if you want to try to weave things together a little bit more. And as we did with the things we leave behind, that will never be made available to anyone except the Kickstarter backers. That's just it. If we hit, we're getting close to £30,000 UK, and if we get there, we're going to do a fiction collection that goes along with it. So, and I know we've already gotten submissions for that.
That's fantastic. And have you found that the limitation, the word count limitation, has brought some surprises? It seems to be a sort of almost like a haiku, or are you finding that it focuses the mind or comes up with different ideas?
I some people did better with it than others. Mm-hmm. I struggled mightily.
Interesting.
With it. I made myself play by my own rules. As you know, I have a position at Golden Goblin as well, and Oscar is constantly on me about how wordy I am. and he's right. I'm very wordy. And it was a nice kind of, I kind of decided I was going to go first to show people that it could be done. Mm-hmm. And it was very difficult to get where I wanted to get in 3,000 words, but I did manage to do it. So.
What ends up, is there sort of have to pull back the clue trail or background? What do you find is the thing you can't spend any time on?
You have to pull back the background. It works well with modern settings because you can assume that people know what a smartphone is. You don't have to explain it to them.
Right.
Whereas if you're setting something in, Cuba in the 1920s, you have to explain what Cuba in the 1920s was like.
Yeah.
Clue trails are necessarily somewhat shorter, but really setting it in the modern era allows you to conserve a lot of words.
Yeah, that's great. All right, I think that will pretty much cover it for us. Is there anything else that you want to add here?
Go Pods!
Hey, that's nice. Thanks very much.
Long time listener, first time caller.
All right, well, take care, and we'll talk to you again down the road.
All right, thanks. Talk to you soon.
Hello, this is Keeper Murph from the Miskatonic University Podcast. I'm here with the one, the only, the ineffable Scott Dorward.
Thank you. I do appreciate being called ineffable. I get called a lot of other things involving F, but yeah, that one I'll settle for.
That's the nicest one I could think of.
Yes. Well, thank you very much for having me on. It's a delight as ever.
Anytime. For the listeners out there, why don't you tell us who you are in case they live under a rock and are not familiar with Scott Dorward?
All right. Well, I'm a freelance writer and editor. I've done a bunch of stuff for Call of Cthulhu and Trail of Cthulhu and Cthulhu Dark and I guess other games with Cthulhu in the name. I seem to have found a niche. I'm also one of the presenters of the Good Friends of Jackson Elias podcast, along with Paul Fricker and Matthew Sanderson. Until recently as well, I was the line developer for World War Cthulhu, but I stepped down from that position a few months ago to give myself a bit more time to actually write, because, well, that's why I got into doing role-playing games, to write, and now I have lots of time for that, which is cool.
Well, that's awesome. So you have all this time, so what are you doing with it? What do you got going right now?
Well, there's some stuff I can talk about and some stuff I can't, unfortunately, because of NDAs. Things that are going on at the moment. Well, the big thing that's just happened, I suppose, is that there's a campaign that I wrote with Matt and Paul for Pop Cthulhu called The Two-Headed Serpent. This has just been released in PDF by Chaosium. The print edition will be out later this year. It hasn't actually gone to press yet. They're basically using the PDF as a way of sort of crowdsourcing the last round of proofreading. And once any fixes are in from that, then it'll go off to press. And I believe it'll be out around Gen Con time.
Oh, that's convenient. So we'll have it before Necronomicon, potentially.
Potentially, yes. Mike did mention something about there being plans to have a few copies there at Necronomicon. So, that'd be very exciting. Yeah.
So, what makes Two-Headed Serpent an actual pulp campaign? What's different between it and a normal you know, Call of Cthulhu scenario for second edition?
Well, quite a lot, really. And part of it is that because pulp investigators are so much, pulp heroes are so much tougher than Call of Cthulhu investigators, as Keeper, you can throw a hell of a lot at them and expect them to survive. So with the Two-Headed Serpent, I mean, we've really ramped up the action and the danger. There are monsters in there that we throw in as, you know, encounters or, you know, things that might just happen in passing, which would normally be the climactic thing to a Call of Cthulhu campaign. And, you know, the heroes will generally survive these things. There is much more of a focus on action, less on investigation. There's, you know, more in the way of weird science and strange locations and, you know, really sort of pulpy villains with grand schemes of world domination and stuff like that.
So did you find it different writing for pulp than writing for your typical imprint?
Yes. I mean, part of it was, you know, just this freedom to take the gloves off and, you know, throw in whatever weirdness that we thought would be fun. It's a very different thing structuring a pulp game, because with standard Call of Cthulhu, you tend to think about it in terms of clues and investigation and that sort of build up to horrible revelations. But with pulp Cthulhu, it is much more about the clues providing the connective tissue between action scenes and set pieces and chase scenes. And it ends up with a very different feel. It's much faster paced.
It's almost like the difference between writing a script for a, you know, like a psychological thriller and an action movie. You know, I mean, that's essentially what you've done is
exactly
transfer it to a different genre almost.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, but I mean, there are still all the trappings you'd expect from Cthulhu in there, the same kinds of monsters and, there's the same kind. I mean, one of the weird things about, you know, Bob Cthulhu in play is because you do have all these big monsters and these big shots going on. The heroes, I mean, they tend to physically survive them, but they spend a lot of the time on the ropes psychologically. The whole thing tends to be one big bout of madness, which lends it a very sort of psychedelic, deranged flavor at times, which I love.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Oh, nothing at all. It's how I live my life, Murph.
There you go. Right on the edge, just like I like it. So other than Two-Headed Serpent, what else have you got in the fires?
Oh, gosh, loads of stuff. I've been doing a bit of work the thing that's coming up at the moment, or in fact live at the moment, is the Kickstarter for Fear Sharp Little Needles, which is the new Call of Cthulhu collection from Stygian Fox. So I've got a scenario in there called Unland, which I had quite a lot of fun with. And one of the stretch goals they've got coming up as well is a fiction collection called Puncture Wounds. And I've put in a story for that. I'm still waiting to hear whether it's going to be accepted, but I have my fingers crossed.
I would be really interested in seeing that.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've had any fiction published. I because of the role-playing writing, I've sort of fell out of the habit of writing fiction for a long time and set myself a goal last year of really sort of getting back into it and writing fiction regularly. And so, yeah, it's nice to work those mental muscles again.
I'll be interested to see it because I know we talked before about you going back to the to the MK Writers Group and stuff like that again after all kind of a long hiatus. So I'm interested to see how it's progressed.
Yeah, well, I hope it's progressed well. I've been getting good feedback from the workshops I've been attending, so I hope they're not just blowing smoke, Murph.
I guess we'll find out one way or the other.
Yeah, we will.
What else has we got?
Well, let's see. I mean, the other thing I've been doing a bit of work on recently has been I've been writing some new Cthulhu Dark scenarios.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for Graham Walmsley.
Graham, yeah.
Yeah. So he's got this Kickstarter coming up soon for Cthulhu Dark. And I don't know exactly where what I'm writing fits into all of this yet. But I was very taken with his approach to the Victorian setting. It's not quite the same as Cthulhu by Gaslight. And it's set slightly earlier. It's all set around the 1850s. And, whereas most Call of Cthulhu scenarios, set in the Gaslight period, tend to involve investigators who are, perhaps upper middle class or, certainly moneyed and, the sort of gentleman investigator type. This is much more, Dickensian, I suppose. It's sort of set in London's underworld.
The working class level and beneath.
Yes, pretty much, yes. The whole Victorian idea of the deserving and the undeserving poor. So I've had a little fun creating a group of linked scenarios, which I've loosely titled "Now We Are the Sons of God," which is about the sort of the temptation of for really desperate people to start using the mythos and allying themselves with inhuman forces just as a means of survival.
Oh, how interesting.
I've been playtesting those recently, and it's proved to be rather nasty.
Did you find it different? I mean, you've been doing this for so long, you probably don't even notice, but do you find it different writing for Cthulhu Dark as opposed to, like Pulp Cthulhu or regular Cthulhu?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, Cthulhu Dark is a very different beast because, even in Standard Call of Cthulhu, it's similarly investigative, but with Call of Cthulhu, there is the expectation, or at least the support, that you will have action scenes or at least fight scenes. You may not necessarily stand much of a chance against some of the creatures you come up against, but there's usually the option to pull out a gun or some dynamite or something like that and make a desperate stand for survival. In Cthulhu Dark, there is that the combat section in there boils down to if you fight a monster, you die. So right. That lends it a very different flavor. So it just becomes about investigation and the spiral into insanity. There is little to no action in it, which makes it makes it feel very, very different.
Awesome. Is there anything else you want to talk about that you can talk about?
Yes. So we have episode 100 of the Good Friends of Jackson Elias coming up in a few weeks next month. So we're sort of planning some stuff for that at the moment. And around the same time, we're putting out the second issue of the fanzine that we do for our backers called The Blasphemous Tome, which is all written up now. We got all the artwork for it, and we're just doing the last edits and layout now. And that's been a lot of fun to do.
To you for that. We tried doing that. We did one and we did it, but I can't imagine doing it on a regular basis.
Well, that's a lot of that. Yeah, I mean, we only do it once a year, and the tone we take with it is, it is basically 40 pages of self-indulgent fun, so it doesn't feel like work to write. I mean, we just basically sit down and write whatever crazy crap comes into our head.
You're not bound by a particular premise.
No,
not even close. Just whatever that pops in your head.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's been great fun.
It's always fun, though. I like doing those kind of projects.
Yes. And I mean, there's a couple of things, they're sort of bubbling along in the background as well, which, I'll have to be vague about, but a couple of big projects for Chaosium, which I am very, very excited about. There's one which, I hope we'll be able to talk about soon, because I think it's going to interest and delight a lot of people. But I shall have to be vague.
Yes, very vague, please. I want you in trouble on it, that's for sure. I imagine we'll get an announcement of that before Gen Con, though, right?
I would have thought so, but I mean, obviously all that's down to Mike, but yes.
Yeah. Scott Dord, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me on, Murph. A pleasure as always.
Welcome, Brett, to our newscast update about various projects that are live and ongoing at the moment. We wanted to see if we could talk to you about some of the things that are going on at Arkham Gazette.
Sure, I'd be happy to give you guys an update. It's been a little while since we talked.
It has indeed, and you've had some work in the works. For one thing, that we did announce this a little while back, but Arkham Gazette number 1 is now available on DriveThruRPG, right?
Yes, it is the revamped version of the issue we originally released in, I want to say, 2014, and it's expanded. I think it's about 50% longer. It has a couple new articles. Everything's been revised a little bit at least, or sometimes more significantly. So yeah, it's 75 pages and $8 PDF, 13 for print.
That one is themed on Arkham, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, I couldn't help but do Arkham for the first regular issue.
Yeah, sure. I think it was Aylesbury Pike was 0, is that right?
Yeah, that was sort of a proof of concept I started working on back when the topic had originally been suggested, or the idea of a magazine was suggested by Keith Herber when he started Miskatonic River Press, and then I asked about it, and he said, yeah, you know, we got some books to do, and we're really busy, and then I started putting some notes together, and then, unfortunately, when he died, you know, that I was obviously shelved, and I revitalized it a couple of years back in 2013, I started working on it again. So I did a demo issue for Zero, which was the Aylesbury Pike, and then issues 1 and 2 on my own, and then a Kickstarter for issue 3 in 2015, and then that came out 2016, because it took longer than I expected, as everything seems to if you are working on it, especially on Kickstarter. But
sure,
you know, especially that issue, the issue number 3 was ended up being 120 pages.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, just a little zine, you know,
mission creep.
That Kickstarter also included these upgrades or yes. Sort of revisions. Yeah.
Yeah, I got a professional layout done by Chris Huth, a little bit of new artwork here and there, some new articles, mostly by myself, but a couple other contributors pitched in. Yeah, some new handouts by Dean Engelhardt, and just, you know, sprucing things up, I guess. So yeah, issue 0 was redone last spring, actually toward the summer, and then issue 1 was done around November, but with layout issues and trying to tweak things, you know, especially right around the Christmas holiday. Drive-Thru was a little busy, so that didn't officially come out until the first week of January when it was available for sale, and it has been doing pretty well. So I'm quite happy with that. People seem to have finally, you know, there's enough critical mass of issues out there with issue 3, issue 0, I guess, and issue 1. I know the issue 0 thing confuses some folks, but, you know, it's just I maybe, you know, my little weird tribute to the old free PDF, the Unbound book, which had issues 0, 1, and 2.
Ah, gotcha.
Yeah.
But content yes. In AG1, if people wanted to sure. Go to DriveThruRPG, the link will be in the doobly-doo. And but what's an overview? We've got, I know new content includes diners, for example, yeah. Some layouts.
Overview on Arkham's diners. I took the 4, I think, that Keith Herber originally had in the book, and then you know, a city of size of Arkham, which is, you know, a little nebulously populated, but maybe 35, 45, 50,000 people, probably have more than 4. So I added 2 more working diners, and then 1 more. Well, 1 diner, 1 dining car, which was the original sort of dining wagon or night wagon, I think they were called, where people would roll up a wagon and sell food at night to people coming out of bars or getting off the late midnight shift. And then 1 regular diner, and then 1 burned out, sort of abandoned, spooky, semi-spooky location that you could use for nefarious goings-on. You know, a burned out diner always seemed like a creepy place to have a meeting, so.
Sure.
I went through all of the Arkham scenarios. I think there are 49 that are mostly or entirely set in Arkham. And then pulled out some interesting locations from the scenarios that don't show up in Arkham now, or the Arkham Arkham Unveiled / H.P. Lovecraft's Arkham, and sort of expanded the description of those. It was like a Irish social club and a weird house outside of town with its own abandoned private zoo, you know, abandoned theater. There's a lot of abandoned, creepy locations, oddly enough. I also took a historical thing, which was the, what do they call the state school system, which was, they weren't schools so much as sort of asylums for children and adults with mental illness and deficiencies, you know, things like fetal alcohol syndrome or Down syndrome or, you know, other sort of neurological problems that we might actually treat today. They just sort of stuck them in these sort of semi-rehabilitation schools and pack them off to the side of society. I put one in Arkham called the Gladding School, which was in part based on the real Rhode Island institution called the Ladd School. Sorry for the not very obvious change of name, but there's a lot of scenario options there and opportunities for some creepy stuff going on, obviously with, a very marginalized, isolated group of children. Terrible things can happen. Oh, the other thing they took in was also young girls who were having babies because clearly they had a mental deficiency. it was, just a way to get rid of unwanted kids. And then there's an overview of Thaumaturgical Prodigies in the New England Canon, which is a tome that Lovecraft created originally and then Derleth repurposed. And I sort of tried to chisel all the Derleth off of it because Derleth had it being written in 1805 and no one in 1805 was writing a book title that sounded like it was from 1670. it's one of those, I like to try to include one tome every issue, sort of a deep dive into a particular book. I know I'll eventually run out of them, but for now there's enough. Hi, Lila. How are you, honey? I'm just talking on the phone. Do you want to snuggle with me a little bit while I talk? Yeah, I'm just talking to my friend Chad. Do you want to say hi? No. How are you feeling, sweetie?
Not so much.
Do you need some medicine? We can go to the store in just a little bit. We also have an article, sort of short bits on, New England towns were required by law to put up boundary markers to show where the property lines were. I talked a little about that in one article and how you might use that in a game. And then a couple scenario seeds, one about stolen manholes. And then a prop document of an academic paper, sort of psychological paper, journal article, that's what I'm trying to say, about people who claim there's an invisible monster drinking their blood. And then also the other diners article, a couple strange items we're calling Arkham Curios, or just little artifacts you can drop into a campaign that are scenario seeds or leads into a bigger plot or just strangeness that can sort of spice up your game. And then there's, of course, the index of all the Arkham scenarios I could find, including what monsters are involved, what places are involved, quick synopsis, some keeper notes, ranging from everything from, structural problems with the scenario or, good ways to link it to another scenario, to one scenario very early on. And I believe the Asylum and other tales where the word cemetery is misspelled throughout. So that's a small point, but I noticed it.
Cemetery then, with an A, maybe?
Yeah, cemetery. I think on the map it's spelled correctly, but in the text it's not. And then lastly, there's our scenario, which is the Bosworth House, which is by Ben Wenham, and was a scenario about individual madness, about a woman who has killed her husband. The investigators are tasked to sort of look into why, and for most of them it just seems to be a tragic, sort of domestic tragedy, but for one, they start perceiving hints of something more occult going on. It's a challenging scenario where, one investigator's perceptions don't match the rest, and how do you respond to that? Do you trust your friend, or do you assume they're mad as well?
And lots of good deep dive material if you're running an Arkham campaign, or if you're running a scenario, you can pull in. In fact, I was able to use your diner layout, although I moved it to where I wanted it.
We do have maps of all the diners, which were...
Yeah.
I believe that was Jeff Wilkins who made those for us. It was a nice addition to the issue.
Very cool. And so how many pages is that one, number one?
75, I want to say, including that one blank page we're required to put. No, 70. It'll be 76, including the blank page in back that drive-through makes you put it in there. But yeah, so 75 pages of actual content. So yeah, the all of our print-on-demand copies come with their own free copy of the PDF. So it's 13 for issue 1, 20 for issue 3. And then our issue 0 is print-on-demand. I think it's the print cost, or I rounded up a couple cents so it wouldn't fluctuate too much. It's $3 for the print, but pay what you want for the PDF. So if you want to check it out, the magazine, you can get it free. Sorry, don't squeak the door, sweetie. Yeah, it's print on demand. Our issue 0 is pay what you want for the PDF, and then I think the print cost of printing for the print on demand.
Great. And so, okay, so Arkham Gazette 2 is now in revision. And
yes.
That's the Innsmouth issue. Yep.
Yes, that was the larger issue than issue 1, so it doesn't need quite as much expansion to reach my sort of ideal length. And that has all of the articles are being proofread again, a couple being revised and expanded. I'm rereading all of the Innsmouth scenarios one more time just to see if there's anything interesting I've missed or useful, or see if anything's been added since I made that list back in 2014. I think that issue is 2015, actually. Yeah, that was spring of 2015. Back when they're coming out every 6 months. but that's got,
right,
you know, scenario in it. And then I think 12 articles. I'm going to add one more at least that I had in draft form originally. I think I have two that I can probably easily finish up. My goal is to get that, the text of it all settled by the end of, well, hopefully this month, at least the revisions, and then any new articles would be maybe next month, and then try to get that out by March, April at the latest.
Cool. And Arkham Gazette number 4, which yes, will focus on Kingsport, I understand.
Yes. Long in development, Kingsport issue, since we announced it when we did the Kickstarter back in 2015, but that's got two scenarios currently, a dozen articles, probably closer to 100, 120 pages than issue, that closer to issue 3 in size. It's going to have the Kickstarter scenario, The Bones of Contention by Kevin Ross, who wrote the original Kingsport book, which was out to our Kickstarter backers, but not publicly available anywhere. That's going to be in there. I think the other scenario is by Christopher Smith Adair. And then a bunch of articles. We're still looking for, we can still take submissions because we're still in the works on it. So that's still open. We've got a submissions page. We can also check out our Google Plus group. Either way, we've also got a Twitter account, which I occasionally post things to. You can follow us in social media there. I've got a Facebook page, which I keep forgetting to update because I can't remember my password. I know no one should admit, but it's true.
All right. Well, I think that that's, that covers your Arkham Gazette news. Anything else you want to share?
Well, I mean, we've got I've got a Patreon for Sentinel Hill Press in general, which I use mostly to buy research materials. You know, it took a little bit of a slowdown after our second child came along back in September, but it's picking up again. I think the most recent thing I posted was a sample from a book in development for us called Graveyards of Lovecraft Country. I profiled a cemetery from Blackwater Creek of the scenario of the same name with some updates and adjustments and expansions because the scenario only mentions a cemetery in one sentence, so I could go nuts with it. but, you know, other things in there, just as previews of what we're working on, interesting articles and links, book reviews from books I'm buying, thanks to the generosity of our Patreon backers. I picked up a copy of Lovecraft's Library, the guide by Joshi, and I've been going through that and highlighting some of the interesting books that are available publicly, like on archive.org or Google Books, that Lovecraft had in his library. I'm trying to find the exact editions as best I can. So that's something I'm putting out there just for our backers. Not every book is yet over 1,000, but just the, you know, occult themed titles or ones that might be of interest, ghost story collections and things. Although strangely, he seemed to buy them from all like 1925s. So they're all just barely in copyright.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're probably getting the most recent for those who's getting more recent editions, but you know, like folklore books and things, he tended to get ones from like 1870 because a lot of them came out in the 1880s and 90s. For just $1 a month, you can support a poor child who's trying to buy a lot more books for his library shelf.
Are you talking about yourself or?
Yeah, I am talking about myself. Eventually, I mean, my kids will get these eventually, and hopefully they won't just look at them and go, eh. but I appreciate the chance to talk to you guys about, or I guess to you, about the updates, and hopefully we'll get issue 2 out soon. Issue 4, I'm hoping to get out before Necronomicon. We'll see how things go. The scenarios are written, so that's the heart of the issue, but the other articles are in development. So I think I've got about 40,000 words in-house now, and I'm looking for about 70. So we'll see.
Great. Well, thanks for the update, sure, and I appreciate your time, and we'll catch up with you again down the road.
Take care, Chad.
Yep, take it easy.
Bye.